newly released whistleblower complaint says President Trump's actions pose risks to U.S. national security. A former U.S. ambassador to NATO weighs in.
Richard Nixon, who had to resign in disgrace, never did anything close to this. No president in our lifetime has ever crossed the line that President Trump crossed on Ukraine. That's why he needs to be impeached.
Also, France says goodbye to their leader who opposed the invasion of Iraq. Former French President Jacques Chirac died today at the age of 86. And all you Labradoodle owners out there, close your ears in 3, 2.
I opened a Pandora box and released a Frankenstein monster.
The man who bred the Labradoodle lives a life of regret. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The whistleblower train is rolling down the tracks. Today we saw the release of The Complaint, the 8-page charge written by someone whose name we don't know about President Trump's dealings with Ukraine's new president, Volodymyr Zelensky. The whistleblower accuses President Trump in the document of asking Zelensky to help dig up dirt on Democratic presidential frontrunner Joe Biden. The report also says that the White House tried to lock down records of the phone call between Trump and Zelensky. Today's hearing on Capitol Hill was mostly about procedure. It lasted all morning and went deep into technical legal matters. Joseph McGuire, the acting director of National Intelligence, was at the center of it all. Democrat Adam Schiff, the committee chair, asked McGuire why he didn't deliver the whistleblower complaint first to Congress, as he's legally supposed to.
I'm just trying to understand the chronology. You first went to the Office of Legal Counsel, and then you went to the White House counsel?
No, sir. No, we went to the White House first to determine, to ask the question.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know is chronology. So you went to the White House first. So you went to the subject of the complaint for advice first about whether you should provide the complaint to Congress.
There were issues within this, a couple of things. One, it did appear that
McGuire argued that he gave it to the White House first over concerns about executive privilege. The top Republican on the committee, Devin Nunes, repeatedly called today's hearing a charade.
Welcome, Mr. Director. It's a pleasure to have you here. And you're going to be part of a charade of legal word games.
As for the actual 8-page whistleblower report, it went straight to the point, stating that the actions of the president, quote, pose risks to U.S. national security. Nicholas Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO and to Greece. He also worked on the National Security Council at the White House under President Clinton. Ambassador Burns, Democrats are saying President Trump should be impeached to protect national security. Republicans are saying we cannot impeach in order to protect national security. So outline for us the main national security liabilities for us right now.
Well, the president now has taken a step that no other president in our lifetimes has done. He has openly, transparently asked a foreign government to interfere in our democracy and in our election. That is an abuse of the president's power under the Constitution. It's going to have repercussions, obviously, here in the United States, but it's going to have major implications for the United States overseas. It's turned American foreign policy on its head because for the last 80 years, every president of both parties has seen Germany and France and Britain and Japan as our fundamental allies in the world. In global politics today, we need those allies on 1,000 different issues, from climate change to sanctioning Iran, and the constant attacks on our democratic allies have really hurt the United States. And I think this week's event compound this problem that the president of the United States is not trusted by our closest allies in the world, in Europe and in the Far East.
Did you support the idea of impeachment before this week?
I did not. I'm an opponent of President Trump. I thought that this had to be settled at the ballot box in November 2020 by the American people, and I was hoping the American people would vote him out of office. But after the publication by the White House of this conversation between President Trump and President Zelensky, Speaker Pelosi had no choice. The president abused his power. He crossed a line that no president should cross. She had to move towards impeachment, and I've changed my mind. I think the impeachment should proceed, and the president should be removed from office by the Senate.
Well, impeachment proceedings, it's an inquiry right now. They don't happen overnight. This could take months. How will national security be impacted in the meantime as these proceedings play out? Like, what won't be taken care of?
Well, obviously, the president and his close advisors are going to be completely distracted by the domestic crisis here at home. The great thing for the United States, the silver lining, is that we have a highly professional military. We have a highly professional and nonpartisan State Department in our 288 embassies and consulates around the world. But you're right that the president in our system has substantial authority for foreign affairs, as opposed to the legislative branch. And I think the president's going to be distracted, and that's going to harm the United States.
Nick, you and I have discussed a lot on the show about how the Department of State and diplomacy have really gotten atrophied under Trump. You really believe we're going to be okay?
The State Department has been grievously harmed by this administration. The president has tried to cut their budget by a third. The Congress has refused that, fortunately. The president has not appointed senior foreign service officers, career diplomats to high-level positions. And you saw in this conversation that President Trump had with President Zelensky in July that the president was very critical of a great American ambassador, Ambassador Masha Yovanovitch, who the president kicked out of Ukraine, withdrew her early, and tried to humiliate her because she was standing up for our values and against corruption. And I think the State Department needs to defend her. And all of us who know her, and I know her well, need to defend her honor that the president and President Zelensky tried to diminish in the conversation they had. So I think morale is at a very low point in the State Department. And Marco, it's interesting, the oath that we take as career foreign service officers, career military officers, is not to the president. The oath is to the Constitution. That's been the oath that every American government official has taken since 1789. You can be sure that the men and women of our federal government are going to uphold the Constitution and try to do their best at this extraordinarily unusual time in our national politics.
So the declassification of this conversation memorandum, the transcript was not stored in the computer system normally used for such information. It was stored in a separate system, according to the whistleblower complaint, a system that was used to store classified information of an especially sensitive nature. Why is this such a big deal?
Obviously, you want to protect presidential communications and records of the president's conversations, but there are a certain number of people who need to see them in order to do their jobs and represent the president. And so it's very important that there be a system, and there has been a system for decades, that allows people to do their jobs at a high level. It looks now, from this whistleblower's report, that the president and his aides concocted a system to hide his conversations from the most senior leaders of our own government.
How does the mere release of this memorandum threaten national security?
It indicates that the president of the United States is willing to bring a foreign government directly into our political system. That harms the national security of the United States. How the Trump White House and the president himself thought that this conversation released to the American public would exonerate him is really beyond reason. Richard Nixon, who had to resign in disgrace, never did anything close to this. No president in our lifetime has ever crossed the line that President Trump crossed on Ukraine. That's why he needs to be impeached.
Does the existence of a whistleblower who sees a moral imperative to write and release his complaint, does that give you hope? Because they are, after all, whistleblower.
Well, that's right. And the whistleblower law was established for this kind of situation, when honest, hardworking people in the government see something that they believe is either irregular or harmful to national security or illegal, and they speak up and their jobs are protected. It's an extraordinary thing to be able to, that this document is out in public. I think it's good for our democracy and good for people to know that we have honest, patriotic people working in the government in this administration that has flouted the rule of law.
If national security is damaged by all of this, how will Americans' daily lives be impacted, do you think?
If the president of the United States cannot be trusted, if his word cannot be trusted by our closest allies, then the security of all of us is affected, 326 million Americans. That's what's at stake in this political drama this week.
Nick Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO and Greece, now at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Ambassador, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The ambassador there with a view from the U.S. Earlier this week, we heard from several people in Ukraine. Russia also has a lot of interest in all this. Remember, the U.S. is providing military aid to Ukraine to thwart Russia. The World's Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. What is your sense of the reaction in Russia to Trump's latest scandal involving Ukraine?
You know, you get the sense that there's really one main thread, which is that the Democrats, or the establishment, if you like, couldn't get Trump on Russiagate, this scandal involving the Mueller report that, you know, has consumed Washington over the last 2 years. And having failed to do that, they have to destroy now the president through Ukraine gate. And that may sound familiar because it's very similar to what Donald Trump likes to argue. And I think just to Russians, it certainly plays to this sense that you hear a lot here, that the U.S. political system is absolutely corrupt. It's nothing for the Russian people to admire or want to emulate. And that also extends to not wanting to emulate Ukraine. You know, ever since a street revolution here in 2014, Russian media loves stories that make Ukraine look weak or corrupt or painted as kind of a puppet state of the U.S. And this idea that, you know, Ukraine doesn't have its own sovereignty over its own affairs or decision making, and that even applies to this new young president, Volodymyr Zelensky, this comedian turned populist who's, you know, he's been something of a darling in the Western media. And he certainly doesn't look that great from these transcripts that came out the other day either.
Have Russian media actually started calling it Ukrainegate?
Well, you've seen it from some politicians. Today we had the Kremlin spokesman, in fact, weigh in saying that this was an internal affair of the U.S., nothing for the Kremlin to comment on. This is pretty standard for them. It's what they always say. But lawmakers here are much more pointed. They say this is about the establishment using whatever weapons they have to destroy Donald Trump from draining the swamp or trying to, you know, break the industrial military complex, in this case, arms sales to Ukraine. So, yes, Ukrainegate.
In Donald Trump's press conference yesterday with Volodymyr Zelensky, Trump mentioned that negotiations between Russia and Ukraine regarding the war in the east of Ukraine are going well. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, it's not quite that. There's certainly a hopeful sign. Earlier this month, we saw a prisoner exchange between the two sides. Zelensky has made ending the war in the Donbass and East Ukraine a key goal of his time in office. He says he'll only stay in for one term. And the fact that Russian President Vladimir Putin stuck to the deal was considered a good sign by many. There's been some discussions of more prisoner exchanges and trying to rebuild efforts to continue peace talks between Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France, the so-called quartet. But on the other hand, there are all these intractable parts of the relationship. You know, Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine 5 years ago. It says it has no intentions of giving it back. So it's hard to see how they get beyond that.
So now members of Congress are trying to launch this impeachment inquiry. Have you heard any talk about how this might affect Russia?
No, I think mostly they're kind of doing the political math here, which is that, you know, the chances of passing through Congress are pretty high, but then there's the problems with the Senate. But more importantly, I think they have this sense that Washington will be tied up in knots for months over this, and not a lot is going to happen with the U.S.-Russian relationship. This goes back to some of the attitudes towards Trump that were here during the election season. This hope that somehow Donald Trump could reset the Russian-U.S. relationship. And I think even with what you're seeing now in Washington, there's a sense that Trump was never able to implement the programs he wanted, that this was the establishment, the deep state, which is preventing the U.S. from pursuing the goals that Donald Trump says he wants to pursue with Russia, which is a good relationship, an uptick in cooperation on issues like nuclear proliferation and on terrorism. But again, I think the idea that Washington will be paralyzed by these hearings and then, of course, the presidential elections coming up, you know, that may not be the worst thing at all for U.S. rivals like Russia or China. Gives them room to pursue their own goals.
The World's Charles Maines in Moscow. Charles, thanks for the perspective from Russia.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up, we explore one of Mexico's recent tragedies and mysteries. 5 years on, the disappearance of 43 Mexican college students remains unsolved. A reporter's fight to hold people accountable. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. On walls across Mexico, you can still find large painted murals with the number 43, 5 years after 43 college students disappeared in the southern state of Guerrero. The students had commandeered a bus to attend a protest. That protest itself was to commemorate the infamous massacre in 1968 of a group of students in Mexico City. But the 43 students on the bus were reportedly intercepted by police, and then they vanished. As Emily Green reports from Mexico City, their disappearance remains a grim, unsolved mystery in the country.
Carmen Mendoza is wearing a T-shirt with a picture of her son Jorge Anibal Cruz Mendoza. It's been 5 years since she saw him. 5 years since she received a text from him at 1:16 in the morning asking her to add credit to his phone, that it was urgent. But Mendoza didn't get scared until the next day when her nephew called. He went to the same college as her son.
Mi primo está detenido, se lo llevaron los policías, pero usted quédese tranquila, vamos a ir por ellos.
Her nephew Entonces, said the police detained her son, but to stay calm. As the day went by, though, Mendoza worried and went to the college, where the police still didn't know where her son was, or his fellow students, all 43 of them.
Yo dije, si están secuestrados, entonces les van a, nos van a hablar para pedir un rescate o algo.
She remembers thinking, if they'd been kidnapped, they would have called for help by now.
Digo, si está en el campo, los animales, otras cosas, sin comer, sin nada.
Then more than 8 days passed. She says she imagined her son and his classmates in the countryside with no food. Eventually, Mexico's attorney general announced the results of the government's investigation.
Los testimonios y confesiones que hemos recabado aunadas al resto de las investigaciones realizadas apuntan muy lamentablemente.
He concluded that the local mayor had ordered the police to detain the students so they wouldn't disrupt a political rally. The police then turned the students over to a local cartel, who burned the bodies and dumped the ashes in a river. The attorney general called the results, quote, the historic truth. In a country where extreme violence has left tens of thousands of people disappeared, protest erupted over the 43 missing students. But even the government's grim version of events soon came under attack. Independent investigators say a more likely scenario is that security forces attacked the students because they had, unknowingly, commandeered a bus with a heroin shipment headed to the U.S. The investigators also say there is no evidence that the students had been burned, and to this day, it's unclear where the students were taken. Santiago Aguirre is a lawyer for the families of the disappeared students.
Habla de un sistema de justicia que no funciona.
Aguirre says the case shows a broken justice system. Then, adding to frustration over the case, news broke that the administration of former President Enrique Peña Nieto spied on investigators brought in to probe the case. Aguirre, the lawyer, was among those spied on.
Y el hecho de que no se haya terminado de esclarecer, desde luego que permanece como una mancha sobre la imagen.
He says so many unresolved questions around this case stains Mexico's image. While the Peña Nieto administration never located the students, it did bring forward some suspects. But even that's unraveling. This month, government officials released a prime suspect because, they said, there wasn't enough evidence to hold him. The suspect, a drug cartel leader, allegedly masterminded the crime because he mistakenly believed the students were part of a rival cartel. Mexico's current president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, criticized the decision to release the suspect, suggesting that local prosecutors are taking part in a cover-up.
Vamos a presentar formalmente una denuncia a la Fiscalía General y al Poder Judicial.
The president said he would complain to the Attorney General's office about the suspect's release. But just weeks later, a judge ordered the further release of 24 police officers also arrested in the case. The judge said the suspects had been tortured. Even so, the decision to let them free infuriated Mexico's Undersecretary of Human Rights, Alejandro Encinas.
Es una burla a la justicia.
It's a joke of justice, Encinas says. These decisions encourage silence, complicity, and impunity. For the most part, the investigation into the disappearance of the students is starting from scratch. And the parents of the disappeared students are angry, like Cristina Bautista.
Aquí nos llevan pues ya casi 5 años, todo por culpa del gobierno de Peña Nieto.
She says it's been 5 years of suffering, all because of former President Enrique Peña Nieto. He told us nothing but lies, she says. Since the disappearance of her son, Benjamin, Bautista has moved to the rural town where he went to school in hopes that he will be returned to her. He was 19 when he disappeared.
Para mí y para todas las madres, pues decimos que nuestros hijos están vivos porque el gobierno se los llevó. Las policías.
For me and all the mothers, we say that our sons are alive because the government took them. The police took them. They just don't say where. She's hopeful that President López Obrador will fulfill his promise to find the missing students.
Pero los vamos a ir buscando hasta encontrarlos, porque vivos se los llevaron y vivos los queremos.
We will keep looking until we find our children, Bautista says, because they were taken alive, and we want them alive. For the World, Emily Green, Mexico City.
There are still so many questions about what exactly happened in Mexico 5 years ago. Mexican journalist Annabel Hernandez has spent that time on her own investigation. She can't say where the students are, but she says she has figured out who was involved, who actually kidnapped and potentially killed the students. It has to do with the tight relationship between the Mexican military and a drug cartel. Hernandez says yes, students had gotten on two buses. Also on the bus, heroin from a local cartel heading north to the U.S. The students knew nothing about that. When the head of the cartel heard that people were on the same buses, he immediately turned to the army to get his drugs back. Hernandez believes this led to a coordinated attack by the military and other security forces like state police. She also believes the army thought the students had seen too much.
They were worried about, maybe these students are understanding what we are doing, and that's why they decide to disappear.
Hernandez's investigations, years of countless interviews and scouring documents, shows that the students were likely split up and taken to several different locations. But if they were then killed, where are the bodies?
So the problem is that no one knows where are the bodies. This is the point. No one knows where are the bodies now. Of course, just the military and the people that participate in the disappearance. Of course, they have to know.
But they're not telling anyone what they know or what they don't know. The Mexican army has refused to allow the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to interrogate anyone who was there that night. And what's especially frustrating to Hernandez is that she knows exactly what their names are. She even published their names in her book, A Massacre in Mexico. Despite her relentless work,
no one is in jail.
Publishing the names of government officials potentially involved in a kidnapping and murder is obviously a serious risk. Hernandez says she was attacked and had to leave Mexico. She currently lives in exile. Mexico's new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is moving to prosecute government officials who refused to investigate the crime. Annabel Hernandez says that is a start, but what she really wants is for the people who committed the crime to go to jail.
I mean, I don't know what are they waiting for.
But calling out government corruption and stamping it out, those are two very different things. You're with the World. The woman who started France's Me Too movement called out a man for harassment.
I never wanted to be known. I never realized the consequences, you know, but I felt I did not have choice because nobody wanted to hear me.
The man sued for defamation, and now she has to pay. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. Typically, this is a news week we look forward to a lot here at our program. World leaders are gathered at the United Nations General Assembly in New York, as they do every September, and we get a chance to geek out about diplomacy. A big question many were asking this session, would officials from the U.S. and Iran meet? Or would there be some hallway shuttle diplomacy between the two countries? Attempts to broker a meeting on the sidelines at the U.N. between President Trump and Iran's President Hassan Rouhani collapsed, though. Trump is dealing with other matters. In New York today, the Iranian president at a solo press conference spoke through a translator.
They keep saying that we wish to speak to Iran. We have no problem talking or negotiating, but we are not willing, with the existence of preconditions, to enter into talks.
The preconditions refer to economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. government on Iran. Brian Hook is a State Department special representative for Iran. I asked him if he'd reached out to any members of the Iranian delegation during his stay in New York this week.
No, this is something which we're very much focused on. Our diplomacy here, the president and the secretary of state have made clear many times that we are open to a meeting with the Iranians, but the Iranians continue to say no.
The sense one gets from the White House, and it's not just meeting President Rouhani, there's a sense that an audience with President Trump is an honor. That may be the case with Kim Jong-un, who's been isolated from the world for so long, but the sense one gets from the Iranians is that sitting down with Trump would be a political liability in the eyes of many Iranian people. How do you square that circle?
Well, that's really a question for the Iranians. The Iranians face a choice. They can either accept the diplomatic off-ramps that we have been offering for many years, or they can watch their economy continue to collapse. They're already in a deep recession.
I mean, Iran would say the sanctions are choking them. France's President Macron suggesting economic incentives for Iran to re-embrace the nuclear idea. Can Iran divide the U.S. from its European allies over the nuclear deal?
I think quite the opposite. Now that you have the United Kingdom, France, and Germany all demanding that Iran enter into the negotiations to address its threats to peace and security, which include its missile proliferation, I think, as the French foreign minister said, the Iranian attacks on Saudi Arabia are a game changer.
I mean, we all know what's at stake here with the standoff. Iran's president, Rouhani, warned this week that a single blunder could fuel a big fire in the region. And Saudi Arabia's foreign minister told my BBC colleague, Liz Doucette, this week that appeasement has not worked in response to Iran and a military response was possible. I mean, how worried are you about the possibility of stumbling into war?
If there is a blunder, it is something that will be committed by Iran because it has a regime that uses terrorism as a tool of statecraft. And this is one of the many things that the regime has got to stop doing. They engage in extortion-like tactics like any regular mafia does. And we are denying them that. And I think here in New York at the UN General Assembly, we have seen an increasing frustration by diplomats with Foreign Minister Zarif, who continues to lie about the attacks on Saudi Arabia. He's losing credibility, and the international community is losing patience.
So given the really heated politics in Washington this week, how are you going to make progress on Iran policy going forward?
We hope that at some point pragmatism will prevail in Tehran. It has happened before. The regime does respond positively to pressure. We've seen this many times over the last 40-year history of this regime.
Yeah, but that sounds like a big hope. Won't all foreign policy from the U.S. take a back seat if this nation is focused on congressional hearings? And isn't that frustrating for you?
We have been able to conduct our diplomacy here without any interruption.
It doesn't sound like that. It sounds like that there have really been no efforts made to reach out to the Iranians.
We have made that very clear many times over 2.5 years. President Trump and Secretary Pompeo have said repeatedly that they would meet with the Iranians. The Iranians are not meeting our diplomacy with diplomacy. They are meeting it with military force.
But you've just explained that you really didn't make any efforts to reach out to the Iranians in New York. So where is diplomacy on the U.S. side?
I think you're confusing a couple of things. We have made it clear publicly that we are ready to meet with the Iranians. The Iranians are rejecting that diplomatic off-ramp. We have done everything we can diplomatically to create the conditions for a better path, but Iran is choosing the wrong path.
Do you think Iranian officials are just playing out the clock? Are they thinking, well, if there's a new president-elect in 2020, what's the incentive to cut a deal now?
I think that's a good question. Our assessment is that Iran is gambling that their resistance is greater than our economic pressure. I would say this week at the UN marked a turning point. Iran crossed the line by attacking Saudi Arabia. They are going to be increasingly diplomatically isolated, and it's going to become a very untenable thing for them. So I expect to see Saudi Arabia ask the UN Security Council to take action in response to the attacks against Saudi. And I think we're going to see a lot of countries increasingly comfortable with holding Iran to a higher standard.
You don't think the Security Council would say, well, you know, the United States walked out of this deal that the five partners agreed on. How do we say, go ahead and bomb Iran?
That is not what we said. That is not our position. We do know that being outside of the Iran deal increases the odds that we are going to be able to accomplish our longer-term objective of denying Iran from ever getting a nuclear weapon. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that the Iran nuclear is a bad deal with many, many defects. We have been saying this for over 2.5 years, and we are very pleased to see our European allies agree with us.
Brian Hook, the State Department Special Representative for Iran, speaking to us from the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
In France, former President Jacques Chirac died this morning at the age of 86. Chirac was France's second longest-serving president. He held the post from 1995 to 2007. Americans may remember him most for refusing to join the U.S.-led Coalition of the Willing, which invaded Iraq in 2003. Here is Chirac in March of that year.
L'Irak ne représente pas Iraq today does not represent an immediate threat that would justify an immediate resort to war. France calls upon everyone to preserve the unity of the Security Council.
Que la légalité internationale soit respectée.
Chirac's decision to stay out of that war was a popular one with the French. Gérard Araud was a French ambassador to Israel under Chirac. Araud was also the French ambassador to the United States. He told us how people in France are remembering Chirac today.
Chirac has been around for 40 years. He was elected, I think, member of the parliament in 67, and he was president till 2007. So I think the French see Chirac as the embodiment of their own youth. You know, there is a sort of nostalgia of the past, and Chirac is this past. But on the top of that, he was a campaigner. He was elected by, in a sense, the most rural constituency in France. You know, we have an agricultural fair in France every year. He was well known to spend hours in this fair, tasting all the cheese, patting all the cows. It's also another France, so which explains also the nostalgia, I should say, of the public opinion right now.
People in the United States may know Chirac best for his strong opposition to the Iraq War, which led to a pretty uncommon falling out between Washington and Paris, especially Republicans in Washington. Pretty dramatic stuff with French fries symbolically substituted for freedom fries. What were the most dramatic moments that you recall?
I think, you know, really, there are a lot of comments about the fact that his 12 years of presidency was a bit wasted time for France because he didn't reform the country. But I think everybody will remember him because of that. He said no to a criminal and stupid invasion of Iraq. So, you know, maybe that every man, every human being has a moment in his life. And I think that was the moment of Jacques Chirac. He was, at this moment, the voice of reason and also the voice of morality against the hubris of the Americans and the servility of the countries which were supporting the U.S.
Chirac was also known for his temper. Did you experience any of that firsthand?
Well, you know, he had this outburst of temper in Jerusalem in 96. He was visiting the old city, and he felt that he was totally harassed by the Israeli security. And in front of all the TV, he said, if you don't stop, I'm driving to the airport and I'm leaving the country. But basically, he was a courteous guy. He was a lot of fun, actually. And so, again, now we are in a sort of a wave of nostalgia in France because of the past. But I think what will remain, I said, Iraq. Second point, he was the first one to recognize that actually, during the Second World War, it was not Vichy who persecuted the Jews. It was France. He recognized the responsibility of our country in this period. There was a taboo in the French history, and that's also something that we'll remember.
Yeah, I mean, that acknowledgement in 1995 of France's collaboration with its German occupiers, I mean, that really felt like a sincere return to liberté, égalité, fraternité. But now in this post-Brexit world, his vision seems to be crumbling in some respects. How do you think that colors his legacy?
He left the power in 2007, and he was born in 1932. So it's already a new world that actually he wouldn't understand. The populist wave, for instance, he was very strong against the far right, even if he was himself a conservative. But obviously, the political debate has dramatically changed. Again, let's not try to make Jacques Chirac a prophet. Jacques Chirac was not a prophet. He was a conservative. He was rooted in the old France, the France of, as I've said, the France of the farmers, of the cows, and the France of Gaullism. In a sense, we are entering a new world, which is definitely not his world.
Gérard Araud, the former French ambassador to the United States, thank you for helping us remember Jacques Chirac today.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
The Me Too movement in France is called Balance ton porc, literally throw out your pig, but French slang for report your pervert. A couple of years ago, we spoke with the creator of that French hashtag, Sandra Mueller. She said a former media executive had harassed her.
He thought I was a piece of steak, so a piece of pork, or I don't know, a piece of meat. You know, I'm not. I'm just a woman.
Mueller was inspired by the Me Too movement here in the U.S. She tweeted out hashtag Balance Ton Port along with the name of her harasser, Eric Brion. Brion sued Mueller for defamation, and this week, he won. I asked Sandra Mueller how she's been coming to terms with the verdict.
I'm okay. You know, I'm strong, so if I'm not okay, I won't tell you that I'm not okay, but I need to be okay, so I am.
When the verdict came out yesterday, you said that you may have lost the defamation case, but that other women had won. Explain.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I repeat that. It's not because I lost a case now, but don't forget that I have to appeal the case, so it's not over now. And this movement helped the other woman to speak.
I mean, how surprised are you that we're seeing this kind of consequence for sharing your story on sexual harassment? Are you surprised?
Yeah, the consequences is that I'm punished, and I think I don't deserve that because I didn't lie. I told the truth, like a lot of victims. And yeah, the price is really heavy because, you know, the price is $20,000. It's a lot. And I'm not like a rich girl. I'm not a rich woman. I'm a single mother. And I think the court didn't take care. They didn't make any investigation about how money I make. It's totally unfair. And I don't know what to tell you. You know, I'm not really 1% myself today.
Well, the court essentially sided with your harasser. Why do you think people should take your side and not his?
I never wanted to be known. I never realized the consequences, you know. But I felt I did not have choice because nobody wanted to hear me.
Did you want him to apologize to you?
When he apologized to me, I tweeted, okay, you apologize. It's okay. We can turn the page now. We can go to another direction. I'm happy you apologize. That's finished. That's over. And he sued me. So do you think he really apologized?
If you could go back and change things, would you do it?
No. Why?
You would name him. No, you would name him again.
The word I used were really strong, but it's the way I am, you know? And I won't change anything. Why? Because the way he acted to me, to tell me, do you know what he told me? You are my type of woman. You have big breasts. I'm going to make you all the night. Do you think it's appropriate? Do you think we can always be quiet and not to speak about that and keep smiling? No, I'm sorry. And now it's like he arrested me once when he had these inappropriate words. He attacked me a second time when he put me in trial, and now he won. So it's like I was arrested 3 times. So I think I use the good word.
You know, we were just talking about the late Jacques Chirac, who represented really a different time in France when Balance Ton Port would not likely have been taken very seriously. Where is France at today in this respect? Because the verdict in your case suggests that maybe the clock is turning back.
No, I think, you know, my government in France, they try to make a change. They want to fight. They are really, really, honestly, they are really dynamic on the subject, but it will take time.
Sandra Mueller is the creator of the Balance Ton Port hashtag, France's version of hashtag Me Too. Ms. Mueller, thanks very much for speaking with us again.
Thank you, Marco.
I want to tell you about a man named Wally Conran. Conran is 90 years old. He lives alone in a one-room flat in Australia. And he says he has a lot of time to reflect on his life's biggest regret.
I opened a Pandora box and released a Frankenstein monster.
Conran is the inventor of the Labradoodle, that mop-headed lab poodle mix that kicked off the designer dog craze that we are very much in the middle of. Conran told his dark tale last week to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's podcast, Sum of All Parts, and hence this podcasting music. It all started in the 1980s when Conran was a breeder of guide dogs in Victoria, Australia. One day, his company got a request from a woman in Hawaii.
She was blind, but her husband was allergic to guide dogs. And she wanted to know if we could come up with a dog that she could use as a guide dog and her husband wouldn't be allergic to.
Conran got to work.
At first, I thought this would be a piece of cake. The standard poodle would do the job. It's a good working dog, has a non-shedding coat. Over the period 3 years, I tried 33 standard poodles, but not one was successful.
So Conran decided to go a different route. He set about breeding an entirely new kind of dog, a cross between a Labrador Retriever, the typical breed for guide dogs, and a poodle. 9 weeks later, the first three Labradoodles were born, Sheikh, Simon, and Sultan.
We sent the clippings of the coat and the saliva to Hawaii. There was only one in the litter out of the three that her husband wasn't allergic to. That was Sultan. And fortunately, he trained up and he finished up going to Hawaii, which was great.
The problem was no one would take the other two pups. Customers only wanted pure breeds. That's when Conran had the idea that would one day come back to haunt him.
So I went to our PR lady and I said, can you get onto the media and tell them we've bred a special breed, a breed called the Labradoodle. It's non-allergic and we're using them as guide dogs. It was a gimmick. They were a crossbred. Nobody wanted them, but everybody wanted a Labradoodle.
Labradoodles became a worldwide sensation. Celebrities like Jennifer Aniston and Tiger Woods have owned them. Barack Obama considered getting one. Conran actually wrote Obama a letter trying to talk him out of it. The problem, Conran says, is that the demand created a market for unscrupulous breeders. And now he says Labradoodles have genetic issues.
When I'm out and I see these Labradoodles, I can't help myself. I go over them in my mind and look. I don't say anything to the people. I look at it thinking, has it got hip dysplasia? Has it got elbow problems? Has it got any other problems I can see? I find that the biggest majority are either crazy or have an hereditary problem.
Labradoodle lovers might beg to differ, but that's no comfort to the guy who started the craze, unleashing Frankenstein's monster. Or your very best friend. Tonight, Geneva is going dark. The Swiss city is turning off its streetlights. The event's being dubbed La Nuit est Belle, the night is beautiful. Eric Ashkar is president of the Geneva Astronomy Society. So why is Geneva doing this, Eric?
Geneva is doing this because during the last 4 years, Pascal Möschler, who is curator and biologist at the National Biological Museum of Geneva, and I gave 35 conferences in 4 years, all around Geneva, about light pollution. And progressively, we noticed that in the population, people were quite sensitive to the biodiversity, and also people were trying to see again the stars. And we experimented in cities, five of them around Geneva, experiment where we switched off the light at night, and the people were very enthusiastic. And we proposed to have a larger experience. And today, 150 cities will switch off the light in Switzerland and in France. So it's across the border to allow the people to see the Milky Way.
So let's talk about light pollution for a moment, because it's obviously a problem for astronomers like yourself, but for everybody, including astronomers, why is it a problem in terms of biodiversity, and how big of an issue is it in cities?
The light pollution, of course, creates trouble for astronomers, because when you put light at night, you don't see the stars anymore, so the stars are disappearing. And for biology, when you put the light at night, in fact, you put light on animals that are normally invisible, and therefore they can be eaten. And you change the law of nature in doing so. And for human beings, if we are exposed to too much light, we tend to go to bed later than we should to have a normal rhythm. We should have extremely bright light during the daytime and really a strong darkness during the nighttime, and that helps to synchronize the body clock.
So you're calling this event La Nuit est Belle, the night is beautiful. On one hand, there's a scientific basis for this lights out evening, but the title, The Night is Beautiful, I mean, that's kind of an artistic way of approaching it. Why'd you choose that title, La Nuit est Belle?
We thought about the experience we had with the people in the cities where we switched off the light, and we saw that the people were very enthusiastic to see the sky. And thinking about doing the same project, but at a larger scale in terms of territory, we thought that let's choose a date on the calendar where the Milky Way goes across the sky like an arch, and so that the night will be beautiful.
So I'm assuming there's a new moon tonight. In other words, there won't be any moon out, and you won't have that light to interfere with the Milky Way.
The date was chosen close to the new moon, because when you have the full moon, you have the light of the moon is in fact reducing the contrast in the sky and you see less stars. And we have selected the date so that the stars will be very bright.
What are you really hoping people see when they look up in the night sky?
The hope behind is to, as a human beings, we are coming from universe because our body, the Earth, all atoms we know here were made in stars that blasted in the past, and all atoms came back again to form the Earth and ourselves. So our body, everything we see is just stellar dust. And seeing the stars again is to see our roots and to give the people the wish to see more the stars, because the light pollution has more or less increased around 100% over the past 20 years. And the wish of this event is all the cities in the world, I'm thinking about London, I'm thinking about New York, that they could do such an event also to show their population how the sky is beautiful and how the night is beautiful.
Eric Ashkar, the president of the Geneva Astronomy Society. Eric, we're some 6 hours ahead of you, so I sincerely wish you a good night with clear skies. All the best.
Thank you very much.
One by one, from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. This is Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, so time for us to fade to black. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.